Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There have been few periods of greater political turmoil in the history of our city and of our country than the middle of the 17th century. About midway on the historical timeline between the plays of Shakespeare and Jonson appearing on the London stage and the Great Plague and the Great Fire, Parliament rose up against its king. In the confusion of the civil wars and the interregnum, one people's organisation in particular had a decisive influence on all that was to follow. It's Saturday, the 14th of March, 2014. I'm in Quentin Wolfe, and this is Londonist Out Loud.
Hey, baby, let me take you down to a place of strange sights and sounds you ain't never seen the like before. Just a stone's throw from your front door.
Well, hello, hello, listener. We find ourselves at the beginning of this podcast in Guildhall Yard, and that's not the first time I've said that on this show, but we're here with a different hat on than usual. Quite often I've visited Guildhall, and it's been my pleasure to speak to people operating various things on behalf of the Corporation of London. The Guildhall Art Gallery is to our right, the library to our left, and Guildhall itself, of course, straight ahead. We're interested in Guildhall, but we're coming from the position of one of the 17th century's greatest electro-gypsy bands, The Levellers. And with me is historian John Rees, and we're going to find out more about our escape routes from Guildhall.
Yeah, well, it's certainly true that those Levellers have an interest in our Levellers of the 17th century, and they worked on, in fact, an album called Freeborn John, which the folk artist Reverend Hammer produced a little while back, and he's going to be performing at the Lilburn 400 conference that I'm organising this Saturday. So from your link to this link, there is a link.
There is a link, and we'll revise that link and spell out what's going on in Bishopsgate this weekend, today, in fact. The escape route is important, though. I gather the last time that the Levellers were here, they had to sneak across the roof of Guildhall to get away from the authorities.
Well, some of the people that were in favour of the parliamentary side in the war did. They were besieged in here by a peace party of demonstrators who wanted to make peace with the king, and it all turned so violent that they broke into the Guildhall, and the people in there, some of them at any rate, escaped over the rooftops. There's a great 17th century pamphlet describing them leaping from rooftop to rooftop across 17th century London to make their way away from the crowd.
Now, listener, as you know, sometimes security guards spot a microphone muffle and go into a red-eyed rage. And if we see a posse of such people heading our way, we're going to climb up on the roof and no, we're not going to do that. What I think we should perhaps start with, taking a step back, historically speaking, is understand what this group was all about and the circumstances under which they developed. They weren't sort of a traditional political party in the way we would think of one now, were they?
No, but they might have been the kind of beginnings of that kind of organisation. I mean, the term political party wasn't really in use when it was used in the 17th century. The word party, it was meant a side in a legal dispute. But during the course of the revolution, it actually became the beginnings of modern usage, that they would talk about John Pym, one of the great parliamentarians, and his party, and John Lilburn and the Levellers and the Leveller party. So it was just on the cusp of being used in that way. Now, of course, the Levellers weren't a political party in the kind of dues-paying social democratic sense that we have today, and that really only arose in the last part of the 19th century. But they were an organised group. Perhaps we would call them a political movement in today's language. But they did have a newspaper, two in fact, that supported them. They did pay subs. John Lilburn used to get up at public meetings and saying, we can't do this without money, and produce from inside his coat a list of things, of leaflets and petitions that were being produced. And they had a treasurer that used to collect a sliding scale of subs according to how wealthy the supporters were. So they had some of the attributes of certainly of a political organisation.
And they were very much activists then, as well as political philosophers.
Yes, if we're talking about an organised group of people who were working the block and tackle, the pulleys and levers of the English Revolution, the Levellers are that group of people. They weren't the only people, obviously. They were a minority even within the parliamentary camp, but they were the most radical organisation on the parliamentary side. And at decisive moments in the English Revolution, they were some of the most organised people driving it forward.
The Civil War is shrouded in the fog of war. One of the common misconceptions, I think, is that it is a war, which of course it wasn't. And then there's the name Levellers itself, which, along with the Diggers and the Shakers and the Quakers and the Crackers, it seems to hide something that seems vaguely amusing and vaguely silly, but I don't really understand what it is. Was that a derogatory term? And again, taking a step back, where do they first surface? Is it as a direct result of the Civil Wars?
Yes, and in John Lilburn's case, the most famous of the Levellers, a little before that. During the 11 years personal rule, when Charles I decided he didn't need to call a parliament, he was just going to run the whole show as a kind of divine right of kings, which he was a big defender of, there was an attempt to clamp down on dissent within or opposed to the Church of England, and many people didn't like the way in which Charles was taking the church. They thought it was too Catholic, there was too much ceremony, there was too much idol worship. They were in favour of a more thoroughgoing Puritan Reformation, and John Lilburn was one of these people, and he was smuggling in dissenting pamphlets from Holland, and that was the first time he ran into trouble with the authorities in the late 1630s.
We know, of course, Holland staunchly protested. I didn't realise that Charles I was... He wasn't himself a Catholic. Was he married to a Catholic?
He was married to a Catholic, but what they objected to was Catholic-like forms of worship. They thought that Charles I and his Archbishop Laud, was driving towards a high church form of church government and church ceremony, and also that this was being enforced in a kind of very, very powerful way. You've got to remember, really, when we're talking about the church in the 17th century, we're talking about an institution which is a massive landowner, b you're still paying taxes to it, c it's compulsory to attend it, d if you don't attend it, you can be dragged before the courts, fined or imprisoned. So it's an institution which plays the same role as a landowner, the education system, and a large part of the media does in our society today.
Yes, that enforced attendance part puts a new complexion on it. But what differed in Protestantism?
Well, they were in favour of a much more democratic church setup. You could elect your ministers, or many of them wanted to. And in certain places in the city, just around the corner here in Coleman Street, there were certain churches that had acquired the bizarre capacity to elect their preacher. And when they did so, they elected radicals. And so there was dissent within the Church of England, which thought that there should be a much more democratic church setup, there should be a much plainer form of worship, that in the gathered churches that anyone could stand up and testify, rather in the way that Quakers do today. In fact, Quakers, of course, have their origin in this period. So it was a challenge, a political challenge, as well as a kind of theological or religious challenge, an institutional challenge to this way in which the society was run. Remember, it had been Charles I's father, James I, who said, no bishop, no king, i.e. if you challenge the church hierarchy, you're going to end up challenging the political hierarchy as well, and he wasn't wrong about that.
That word radical packs a heavy punch in the current climate. I wonder what radical looked like in the time we're talking of.
Well, it looked like religious dissent, that's certainly true, and has something in common with current usages. It had the idea that you were beginning, as the kind of, you know, etymological origin of the word has it, that you're beginning to look at the deep origins of problems, that you aren't satisfied with amelioration or partial change, that you want something fundamental to change in the society. Although that only really gathered its true force during the course of the revolution itself. Revolutions famously radicalize the people participating in them. But both to the kind of traditional left, but also some of the people who were against the king in the beginning of it looked into the abyss and said, whoa, if this is what it means, then maybe we're better off with the existing setup. So there was polarization as well as radicalization.
So there's a don't question us thing going on here. What about modern day analogues? Is there anything that bears useful comparison going on in the world at the moment?
Well, there is a general way in which all revolutions have some similarities. So if we think, for instance, about the Egyptian revolution in the Arab Spring back in 2011, that starts with a tremendously isolated regime. Really, only the dictator and his immediate cohorts are really willing to go into bat for this regime. The vast majority of the rest of society is either disaffected or actively in opposition to it. They gather in a kind of broad front. But as the revolution develops, more and more fundamental, more and more radical questions are asked. What do we want to replace the existing regime with? How are we going to get it? We've stripped away the outer defences of the regime, but there's still a hard core of the regime there. How are we going to deal with the kind of irremovable element on the other side? So there's a certain logic to revolutions which, although there are obviously very, very great differences between any modern society and England in the 17th century, you can see some of those patterns re-emerging, yes.
It sounds a little like what you're describing there, though, might involve a majority of people who aren't, at least at the beginning, politically active and are sort of hanging back and tending their vegetables and trying not to get involved.
Yes, and again, this is something which is common, I think, in all revolutions. They have to have a mass dynamic even to begin, and the English Revolution certainly did. John Lilwyn was one of the people who led the apprentices, the apron youths, as they were called, down from the city of London to besiege Westminster. And it was those crowds, the threatening nature of those crowds, that was one of the things that got Charles I to quit London and set up the Royal Standard in Nottingham and to begin the Civil War. So there has to be a mass dynamic at the beginning. But as that evolves, of course, more and more people begin to see that the whole fate of the society is now in the balance, that you might want to avoid the revolution, but the revolution won't avoid you. And so they become drawn in on either side. Some remain kind of resolutely neutral. There was a movement towards the end of this period, after England had been through two civil wars, the clubmen, who were neutralists, who just said, look, we've had enough of the marauding armies, we've had enough of the taxation, we've had enough of this, we just want to be left in peace. And they would kind of ward off soldiers, that they were armed, that they would ward off soldiers from either camp, actually.
Oh, so a neighbourhood watch gone
crazy, yes.
What about right here? I'd love to tie us back into London itself. One thing I think I know about the Civil War was that it wasn't cut down neatly down any geographical lines. You could sort of make broad statements about it, I think, but it was also within families, different positions being held.
Yeah, absolutely. It divided the society down the middle. And it divided London as well. Although for the most part, London, and certainly the Royalists thought this, was the treasury, the armoury of the parliamentarian side. But there were certain points at which that was contested. I mean, I mentioned right at the beginning of the broadcast that peace protest here at the Guildhall. That was to settle with the king. That was a protest of conservative forces in London saying, we've had enough of this, we didn't realise it was going to be a fight to the end, we just thought we were fighting the king so he would come to a more reasonable accommodation with us, it's time to make that peace now. So that presence was always here in London, and one of the crucial things that the Levellers did is when that was most threatening, just after the Second Civil War in 1647-1648, when it looked as if the conservative forces in the Parliament and here in the city might do a deal with Charles, the Levellers smashed into that possible consensus for a settlement and broke it up, really. They petitioned on a mass scale, they mobilised the city, they put backbone into Cromwell and his allies and forced the issue to the end where there was the purge of Parliament and the execution of the king.
Well, I was beginning to feel that you were painting a picture of pacifists at the beginning there, but it sounds as though that really transformed over the course of a very, very short space of time.
Yes, and they could never be really described in that way, partly because they'd been through the most bloody warfare that this country has ever seen. The revolution really begins in London in 1640. The Civil War itself, when Charles leaves London, sets up his standard in Notting, that begins in 1642, ends in 1645, and then there's another outbreak in 1648 where, precisely because there's been so much vacillating on the parliamentary side, there's so many people who want to do a deal with the king, including at this point Cromwell, that the royalists regain enough confidence to launch a second civil war. It's only when that civil war is won, the second civil war is won, that the really radical political conclusion is drawn. We can't make a peace with this man. He is, as they called him in that day, a man of blood, and they had to settle accounts with him.
Does that mean that, something I didn't realise, does that mean that the first time around Charles was successful, if not victorious? Did he have the public behind him?
No, the astounding thing is he was thoroughly beaten on the battlefield in Marston Moor and then at Naseby in 1645. The royalist armies were utterly trounced by the new model army under Fairfax and Cromwell. But such was the political conservatism in the society that it's almost as if even the victors couldn't imagine a settlement that didn't have the king in it. And so there's this long process of vacillation on their side, of negotiation with the king. And in many ways, it's only Charles's stubbornness that prevents him from regaining the throne. But he is so stubborn and so insistent on the divine right of kings that even though who would like to do a deal with him can't come to one with him. He's always trying to bring the Scots back in or do a deal with the Irish to start another war, and indeed succeeds in doing so. And it's at that point that even those that would like to do a deal with him are really thrown into the camp of those who've always said this won't work.
I feel a little sorry for him. That sounds like a character defect to end all character defects, stubbornness of that sort.
Yes.
I believe that Oliver Cromwell wasn't as big a figure early on in the Civil War as he came to be. And it was John Pym was really a very important figure at the beginning, wasn't it?
Yes, and that again is typical of revolutions. It's not always the case. In fact, it's frequently not the case that the people who start off leading the revolution end up being the people who lead its most radical phase. They're often kind of foot soldiers in the first phase of the revolution, although in Cromwell's case he was actually a cavalry officer. So, but he was, you know, from the ranks. He was a yeoman farmer of no particularly great standing. He was only elected as an MP right at the beginning of the Civil War, and it was people like him that proved to be the backbone of the parliamentary side. And the royalists go crazy about this. They say, look, there's all these upstarts, that these people have no family, no breeding, no anything. And then the people behind them are even worse, as when one of the great leveller heroes had a huge funeral, Thomas Rainsborough was killed in the Second Civil War, had a huge funeral, which marched not far from here, just down the road here. The royalist newspapers were saying, oh yes, there's thousands of people following me. It's Dick the Door Sweeper. It's Tom the Tapster. It's, you know, just what are these people even thinking that they can have a say in the way the nation is run?
I want to bring us back to the Levellers very firmly, and the central figure there. Could we go right back to where he comes from and how he got politically engaged?
Yeah, so John Lilburn is he's a Geordie, he comes from the northeast. It's clear how exactly you want to draw the Geordie boundaries, but he comes from the northeast. He comes down to London. He's an apprentice in the city of London. He's a religious radical, as I say. He's opposed to the innovations in church worship that Charles I is pushing through. He's a Puritan dissident. He becomes involved with a group of three people called the Puritan Martyrs, who were tortured and imprisoned for dissident Puritan belief. And when he's mixing with these, he begins to be involved in the business, which was already an established one, but of bringing radical clerical pamphlets in from Holland. He's betrayed, arrested, put in the Fleet Prison, and then as punishment, he's tied to the back of a cart at what now is Fleet Street, and whipped all the way to Westminster Yard, put in the stocks. He's still throwing pamphlets from his coat pockets while he's in the stocks and making speeches until they gag him. And his defence in court was that the Lords had no right to try him. And this is where he gains his title as Freeborn John. He says no freeborn Englishman can be tried by the House of Lords, and that there should be no... And again, in many court cases subsequently, he argues that there should be no secret trials. There should be no trials where evidence is gained by torture, that no defendant should be allowed to incriminate himself from his own forced testimony. And indeed, we're still arguing over those things today. So that's where his title of Freeborn John Lilburne comes from. He fights in the Parliamentary Army. He's captured by the Royalists at the Battle of Brentford on the outskirts of London. He's held prisoner in Oxford, and they're just about to execute him. When Parliament says, if you execute John Lilburne, we will execute the Royalist prisoners that we hold. His wife, Elizabeth Lilburne, while she's pregnant, has to ride from London to Oxford to deliver this news just in time for him to be set free. He returns to London as a hero. He serves as a lieutenant of Cromwell's in the new model, not in the new model, before it becomes the new model army. And he's a hero of the London crowd from that point on, and a thorn in the side of every government, including Cromwell when he comes to power, from that moment on. And he builds around him a network of secret printers, of petitioners, of the organisation that becomes called the Levellers by Cromwell, actually, as an insult in 1647.
Right, yes, I wonder whether that might be the case. It's difficult not to pick up resonances of the things that are going on in the news every day at the moment in what you say. It's called Puritanism at this point in history that we're talking about, and I guess the ideals put forward by groups, who I don't want to give any publicity to, their ideas certainly purport to be highly puritanical, but very extreme in that way. And so I guess almost instinctively I'm looking for some sorts of hypocrisy. I can't help noticing that there's actual engagement.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
With the political system in the UK going on amongst the people that you're talking about, with your background as, I think it's safe to say, somebody erring to the left in your thinking,
indeed,
is it all a picture of righteousness amongst the Levellers, or are there other sides to them?
Well, you might make that accusation more of some of the other radical sects, like the Diggers and the Ranters, who certainly... you could say confused liberty and license. I think it's less true of the Levellers. I think they were some of the most politically honest people in the revolutionary experience, partly because they stuck to their principles no matter who was in government. So even when their side had won, and their side Cromwell and his associates were in government, in power, were beginning to enrich themselves. The Levellers were offered, or John Lilburne certainly was offered, inducements to join that side, and he didn't. He kept up the criticism and said, and Richard Overton, his friend and printer, said, what is the difference between Cromwell's Council of State and a monarchy if it continues to oppress the people? So I think that charge is pretty hard to make. I mean, the Royalists made it. They said, oh, John Lilburne's always drinking and playing cards and this, that and the other. But I take that to be, well, A, petty, and B, probably untrue, actually.
Probably untrue.
Well, the cards, maybe. The drinking, I certainly think there was a fair amount of drinking, yes.
We're still in the stage then when water wasn't particularly safe, aren't we?
Yes, indeed, yes.
We might let them off on that. We're going to take a short break to get a word from our sponsor, and then we'll be right back here with John Rees at Guildhall.
Londonist Out Loud is sponsored by Audible. To claim your free audiobook from a range of 60,000 titles, try the Audible service on 30-day free trial. Audiobooks can be saved as MP3s and played on your compatible phone, tablet, or desktop, or burned to CD, and they're yours to keep. For your free audiobook, go to www.audible.co.uk/Londonist and click through.
You're listening to Londonist Out Loud. I'm at Guildhall with historian John Rees. And John, you've been looking at Audible yourself. What would you recommend on there at the moment?
Well, there's a fantastic novel about this period, The Crimson Ribbon, by Catherine Clements, who's speaking at the conference. One of the things that we tried to do with the conference is to say that the memory of Lilburne and the Levellers is carried not just by historians, but by reenactors, by authors, by the people who wrote the Devil's Whore TV series. They're all coming down because I think that historical memory is carried in a variety of different ways, and often not by the official school system in this country. It's an incredible thing, but if you want to pass the citizenship test and come to this country as an immigrant, you have to know about the English Revolution and indeed about the Levellers. But if you're at school in this country, if you're a school child in this country, it's not part of the syllabus. So that gets carried by a variety of other channels, and we've tried to bring them all together, and Catherine Clements' book, I think, is part of that.
There remains then that suspicion that the authorities really don't want anybody asking too many questions, particularly young minds. Listener, the conference that we're talking about is underway right now. So stop whatever you're doing, at small asterisk, put your shoes on and get down to the Bishopsgate Institute while we tell you what's going on there. Small asterisk at the bottom, don't put it down if it's dangerous to do so. That's the official position of Londonist.
Good to know. It's going to be a very interesting day, I think, because as I say, there's an interesting mix of historians who've begun to kind of relook at the Levellers, probably for the first time in a generation. They became unfashionable when the so-called revisionist school, which was quite a conservative interpretation of the English Revolution, dominated historical thinking. But that moment has passed, and there's a new generation of historians that are looking at the Levellers again, and some of the best of them, I think, are speaking at the conference. But as I say, not alone, with people who've made TV series, with people who've written novels, with people who've written songs about the Levellers, and with politicians and activists who also carry that tradition. So we've tried to design it so that there's a broad sense of how the society is reflecting on John Lilburne 400 years after his birth.
And if I know the Bishopsgate Institute at all, then I am expecting this to be a question of dipping in and dipping out as you please, and being able to fill your intellectual boots.
Yeah, indeed, yeah, right up to 9 o'clock in the evening.
We left off, well, it felt like we were sort of just at the beginning of the second of the two English Civil Wars.
Yeah, indeed. And this is where the Levellers really come into their own. They'd always been known as the London Levellers because they were so concentrated in the City of London, indeed right around this area here, this area, Coleman Street and the Guildhall. This part of the City of London was the kind of red Petrograd of the English Revolution. You could walk down the road there and there would be unlicensed so-called tub preachers just preaching above pubs, contested. The kind of authorities would turn up and try and disperse the crowd, the right-wing controversialists with right lengthy pamphlets about how terrible everything was down in Coleman Street and Swan Alley and how radicals were gaining a hearing. And the left was certainly met in a pub just down there on Old Jewry called the Whalebone. So this was absolutely the centre of it. But by the end of the First Civil War, there were many people in the New Model Army who'd been radicalised by the experience of war. As I say, this was the single bloodiest conflict ever as a proportion of the population killed, bloodier even than the First World War in this country. So people had gone through an absolutely life-changing experience. Many of them had emerged from it saying, as their manifesto said, we are no mercenary army. You know, we fought for a principle. And what are we getting out of this? Where is the freedom that we fought for? So there was a whole new constituency in the army for the Levellers, and they linked up with them very quickly. This is where the famous Putney debates held when the army was camped just down the road outside London, in partly to overawe the Conservatives in the city. They just parked the New Model Army on the outskirts of it. Eventually, it came over London Bridge and actually took possession of the city and drove out some of the Conservatives out of the Parliament.
This is classic revolution behaviour. On the lawn.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And what is absolutely characteristic is as they are mounting this military challenge, they stop and in Putney Church and the surrounding area, they have a debate about what we're doing. What are we fighting for? And by this time, the regiments in the army have elected agitators. It meant simply agents in the 17th century, but it's where the word comes from. They were directly elected by the ordinary soldiers, and they forced the grandees, as the Levellers called them, the senior officers of the army, to allow them to be in a joint council of the army to decide the army's policy. And they met in the Putney Church and debated, what are we going to do? Ordinary soldiers, one of them is described by the clerk who takes it down. He just has next to his name in the transcript, Buffcoat, because that was the military, the heavy leather cavalry jacket that they wore. That's all his name is. He's just Buffcoat. And he says, you know, what are we fighting for? What rights have we got yet? And the Levellers bring forward the famous Agreement of the People, which says we have to have a government based on popular sovereignty. And Cromwell and his son-in-law, Henry Ireton, say, we can't do that. We can't do that because if we do this, it'll be the end of property. Henry Ireton says, everything that I say is because I have an eye to property. In other words, democracy can't live with property, and you people insisting on democracy, it'll be the end of property. And that is probably the great original of that debate. And that debate is still being had now. When the Troika say to the Greek government, terribly sorry, you've elected the wrong government, that debate, property or democracy, is still going on. It happened first here.
Is that where we get the idea of property is theft, that idea?
Well, that was Proudhon much later, a French socialist, semi-anarchist, but the origin of that idea that there is a conflict between popular sovereignty and private property, that's right, that point of origin is really, in any modern sense, is the English Revolution.
That moment that you're describing there, as it sounds to be such a pivotal moment, I must be completely clear in my mind, was the moment's pause and the insistence on knowing exactly what they're about, was that because there were a lot of competing ideas? Was it because they got that far and realised they didn't know what they were doing? Was it just to make sure everyone's on the same page? What was the character of this?
Well, it was because the First Civil War had been won. This was a victorious army, and as soon as it had defeated the king, the question was, what next? And the answers to that question were myriad. One answer was, we'll negotiate with him, we'll get him to lay aside some of the worst excesses that we didn't like, and we'll, as one of the cavalry regiments called it, re-enthrone him. That was one idea. Another idea was that there would be a kind of more severe set of restrictions on the king, and it ran in a spectrum right the way through to just beginning to emerge the idea of a republic. We don't need a king. And all points in between those two things.
What you're saying about property there and the short-livedness, relatively speaking, of the Levellers and the need for the Levellers reminds me somewhat of the Occupy movement in some respects, not all. And I mentioned before that one of the big accusations that people used to shoot down the idea of what Occupy was all about was that there didn't seem to be a single clear direction and a single clear goal. And so a lot of people wouldn't give them the time of day. And it seems to me that where the Levellers and the parliamentary forces more generally could unite behind a dislike of the status quo and perhaps focus on the obnoxious character of the king in order to do it. If you haven't got that rallying foe, you've got a bit of a problem, haven't you? In a way, one of the safest bets for a ruling political class today or something is to make everything nice and fuzzy and make the target indistinct.
Yes, I think that's true. But what I would say about the Levellers is they supplied that vital element of clarity. When they brought forward the agreement of the people, it was a very short pamphlet form. It went through four different versions. It was distributed widely as a pamphlet and amongst the armed forces, and it provided exactly that focus. It answered the question, what did we fight for? And the answer was, we fought for a popular sovereignty which has to be agreed by the mass of the population, and it contains these five or six points. It varied. And it got so far as actually, after the execution of Charles I, the agreement of the people was actually laid before Parliament as this is what we would like to see. Now, it got very quickly brushed aside by Cromwell and Ireton. They were in power now. They didn't really need a more radical programme then. They were more or less happy with what they got, but it's a tribute to the Levellers that they couldn't be ignored. They had to be militarily defeated, partly because they had strength in the army, and so there were a series of mutinies in 1649 after the execution of the king, one just down in Bishopsgate, a stone's throw from where we'll be having the conference, led by a young soldier called Robert Lockyer. Cromwell and Fairfax had to come down and after 2 days seize the colours of the regiment back, take him and shoot him, have him shot in St. Paul's Churchyard. And then there's the famous Burford mutinies very shortly afterwards, which were a series of military risings across the West Country, eventually defeated at Burford in the Cotswolds by Cromwell charging down the Leveller regiments. And that's where, in exactly the same year as all this is happening, Cromwell then gets hold of John Lilburne, who he's had locked up in the Tower, drags him to the Guildhall here and puts him on trial for his life. Twice Cromwell tried this. Again, a few years later, he tried it. Both times, juries refused to convict him. And there were church bells and bonfires from here right the way through the city of London when he was released.
So what was going on here then? Was it that Cromwell had lost the plot and was, becoming authoritarian in the same way that the king was? What was happening?
I think often in victorious revolutions, there comes a dividing point where for some people, once they defeated the king, and there was a republic, that was far enough. That was as far as they thought the social base of England would travel. And there are others who said, this victory is not complete enough. We're not talking about popular sovereignty. You've got a military government. This is what the Levellers said to Cromwell. You haven't got popular sovereignty. You're ruling by the sword. And we want popular sovereignty. And Cromwell, even though he'd relied on an alliance with the Levellers to defeat the king, said, no, we're not going any further than this. This is as far as we go.
And he didn't want to become a king, did he?
No, and to his credit, he was offered the crown and turned it down. So I think it's wrong to say that Cromwell wasn't a revolutionary of a particular type. He was. But he halted the revolution at a point less radical than the point that the Levellers were aiming for. And as he was heard to say through the door of somebody listening to him talking to his confederates, he said, either we crush the Levellers or they will crush us. And that's what he proceeded to do. It was basically broken up as an active element in politics, more slowly than some historians think. It had an afterlife, a little bit longer than most historians think, but certainly by the time you've got towards the end of the 1650s, just before the restoration of the monarchy in 1660, in 1659, as Cromwell dies and his son becomes protector, there's a brief flurry again of Leveller activity, saying, okay, you know, that era is over, maybe now we can do something more radical. But the restoration puts an end to that. But it lives on then as a political tradition. Radicals in the 18th century, John Wilkes had Leveller pamphlets, and you find them in the libraries of the Chartists and so forth. So it lives on then as a kind of intellectual and political inspiration.
those dying days of the interregnum, what I'm hearing and what you're saying is really a police state and an occupation of sorts. I was struck by some of the stories of what went on for the Quakers, as they had to have secret meetings in houses with false walls, and everything seems to have been driven underground, and there was a resistance. It must have been a huge breath of fresh air to welcome back a monarch who largely stayed out of politics.
Well, it didn't change for the dissenting. In fact, it got worse for the dissenting Christians. For Baptists, for Quakers, the Clarendon Code. Clarendon had been, Edward Hyde had been Charles I's advisor. He comes in as a key figure in the Restoration monarchy. The Clarendon Code then institutionalizes discrimination against dissenting Christians. The 5 Mile Act and so forth. This is all part of the Clarendon Code. So it gets very sharply worse. I've been having a look at what was happening down in my home county of Wiltshire, and the dissenters are meeting, often in meetings of 2,000. This is in rural Wiltshire, out in the woods to avoid persecution. Some former Leveller allies, like Colonel John Reed, who was governor of Poole during the Revolution, is in southern Wiltshire in Porton, setting up a kind of Baptist church there. He's hauled into the Tower of London and examined by the officers of Charles II during the Restoration. So, no, it's tough times under the Restoration for the dissenting Christians.
Well, that surprises me no end, because I have always had the Glorious Revolution and Charles II's period in general as down as the Benny Hill show. Essentially just sex and licentious behaviour.
Yeah, I think that was okay if you were in the court. Out in the dissenting churches, there was less fun to be had.
Not one rule for the rich and another for the poor, surely.
Staggering thought, I know, but sometimes it happens.
Well, thank goodness they had the revolution to sort all that out.
Yeah, indeed, yes. Well, the dissent, that's one of the very real sort of inheritances. It was E.P. Thompson, who was himself, of course, a Marxist historian, who said that the British working class owed more to Methodism than to Marxism. But it's whether or not that's true, it's certainly true that that Baptist dissenting tradition, the Quaker tradition, I mean, today, you look around the country, in London, indeed, in the Friends Meeting House in Euston Road, if there's a left-wing meeting going on, it's probably one of the places it's likely to be is in a Quaker meeting house.
Which leads very nicely into the final question, really, which is, where do we find the strongest evidence of the Levellers' influence today?
Well, I think it is. I think it has become knitted in to the fabric of the left. Christopher Hill, of course, is probably still the single best-known historian of the English Revolution. He was a member of the Communist Party and then left it over the invasion of Hungary in 1956. Going to bookshops today, it's still a Christopher Hill book you'll find on the shelves. And most of the people who've written about the Levellers, most of the books that you pick up about the Levellers, Brailsford's book, which Hill completed after Brailsford died. He was a socialist and a left-winger, and as I say, Hill completed the book. Pauline Gregg, who wrote, published in 1961, but still the outstanding biography of John Lilburn, was a socialist and a radical. So I think that in the trade union movement, the annual Burford demonstration where the Levellers were shot in Oxfordshire, those are the major kind of conduits down which that runs. They're not the only ones. There are many people who aren't on the left who remember the Levellers as well and who respect Lilburn as a champion of civil liberties and so forth, but I would say that's probably in its strongest current, that's where it lies.
Thanks for taking the time out today. Listener, if this has prodded your curiosity into action, then get yourself down to the Bishopsgate Institute, in case you don't know, and by Jove you should. It's Liverpool Street station you want, and you need to cross the road from there and look both ways, but especially left. John Rees, thanks very much.
Thank you. My heart aches for
some far off place. And that's all for this week. My thanks for this week to John Rees. Thanks too to Mark Barr and Bernie Barkley. Theme and incidental music was by Songs from the Howling Sea. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.